News.
Due to the global outbreak of the coronavirus, the Voice of America is taking every necessary precaution to safeguard its employees, so our broadcast will look a little different today and in the near future as we reduce our staffing at VOA headquarters here in Washington. We appreciate your staying with us on Straight Talk Africa. Hello, welcome to Straight Talk Africa, coming to you from my home in Arlington, Virginia, the suburb of Washington, D.C. I am Shaka Sali, and today we will discuss how agriculture can become a critical pathway to prosperity in Africa. Joining us today is Dr. Debisi Araba, the Managing Director of the African Green Revolution Forum, and he joins us from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. Well, I have to say that I am profoundly honored and exceedingly humbled to have the opportunity to host you for the first time on this special edition of Straight Talk Africa, Dr. Debisi Araba.
Thank you very much, Shaka. It's an honor and a privilege to be here.
You're most welcome. I have to say that you come very, very highly recommended, meaning that your reputation precedes you.
Well, I hope to live up to the expectations of the audience and listeners today, and I look forward to a vibrant conversation with you.
Thank you very much. First of all, before we go anywhere really, what is the African Green Revolution Forum?
Well, thank you very much, Shaka. So we're now known by the Initialism, AGRF. The AGRF is a platform. It's a community of platforms focused on helping all partners working with or for the African continent on effective agricultural transformation. And when we say agricultural transformation, of course, I mean a public sector-enabled, private sector-led process. And so all partners involved in that process are facilitated and enabled via the AGRF.
Well, what is the difference between what you call the AGRF and AGRA, the Alliance for the Green Revolution for Africa?
Yes, AGRA, the Alliance for a Green Revolution in Africa, and the AGRF indeed have a complementary relationship. We also have a similar history. So beginning with AGRA, AGRA is an institution focused on inclusive agriculture transformation on the continent of Africa. They are the premier transformation agency for the agri-food sector on the continent. AGRA is also a member of the partners group within the AGRF. As I mentioned, the AGRF is a community of platforms. So within that, we have 26 partners who make up the group, the partners group of the AGRF. AGRA is one of those. And of course, AGRA also hosts the AGRF.
What is the goal for the African Green Revolution Forum?
Good. The goal is agriculture, inclusive agricultural transformation. And of course, we understand that agriculture transformation is not an event. It is a process that continues to evolve, ensuring that Africa and Africans are able to not just feed themselves, but become the agri-food sector within the continent can become a powerhouse for feeding the rest of the world.
What are some of the lessons that you learned previously, especially at the International Center for Tropical Agriculture, which is based in Colombia,
And also, by the way, during the time that you acted as the senior advisor to the Nigerian Minister of Agriculture, who happens to be the current president of the African Development Bank, Dr. Adesine.
Let me begin by saying Africa can feed itself and Africa can feed the world. I am convinced of this fact. Now, prior to joining the AGRF, an institution I joined in May this year, I was the Africa Regional Director at the International Center for Tropical Agriculture, SIAT, now a member of the Alliance of Biodiversity International and SIAT. This is an international research organization that is part of the CGIAR, the International Agriculture Research Consortium. At SIAT, for 4 years, I led research development and strategy on the continent of Africa to engage on how we could provide the evidence base, using science as an evidence base for agriculture development and prosperity on the continent. Two things I would like to highlight here. Of course, we can always come back to my time here. One of the big achievements that I was really proud of was setting out a clear and defined roadmap for research, for the research agenda on the continent, and ensuring that scientists understood that to move the or to advance the agriculture development agenda, we needed scientists to become more political in their thinking, and politicians to understand science, because this partnership is needed. And you also need the private sector to be able to create the enabling environment for the private sector to lead. And so how do we leverage the science, curate the science, develop the science that provides the information for private entrepreneurs at all levels? You know, so I know some of your listeners might have heard of the term smallholder farmers. These are people at the production hub of agriculture and food systems at the small scale. But it's not just smallholder farmers we're looking at. We're looking at every single actor along and around the agri-food space. So people producing at the smallholder level, people producing at the large scale level, and everybody in between. So those working in aggregation, those working on finance, those working on infrastructure development, etc. The lesson I learned from supporting the research agenda, as I mentioned, is Africa can feed the world. And I believe the catalyst or the conduit to achieving this reality is through partnerships. We need to understand that we are all on a journey and we need to support each other on this journey. Of course, prior to joining the International Center for Tropical Agriculture, I was a senior advisor to the Minister of Agriculture. And there I, in addition to supporting the minister directly, I was also responsible for building resilience within the agriculture transformation agenda policy portfolio of the administration. And it was an exciting period, I think, you know, understanding, traveling across the country, Nigeria, and seeing the transformative potential that agriculture, you know, when done right, when you align the policy incentives for the private sector to lead, you have the right evidence base that informs the public policy frameworks. It looks almost magical when things work. And, you know, when you've seen success, you know, I think you never want to go back to mediocrity. And so once you've seen success, you know that this can be scaled and replicated not just across the country, but across the continent. And so I am a firm believer in the potential of agriculture to be a catalytic subsector of the global economy to transform the lives and livelihoods of millions of people.
To what extent would you say that the coronavirus pandemic has somewhat not been helpful in as far as your role or your job is concerned?
Wow, that's a that's a multi-layered question, Shaka. I'll begin by saying no one, absolutely no one, even those who potentially envisioned a global pandemic, could have predicted the second and third order effects of the actions we would have taken, how global economies just shut down overnight. And so I like to sort of assure or reassure people that 2020 is not an annus horribilis. It's not the worst year on record. What it is, it's a shock to the system to let us understand that our global economy has its vulnerabilities, you know. And so what happened, what happens in China has the potential to impact what happens in Kenya and vice versa. Now, we've had countries close their borders, not just to trade, but to movements of goods, services, people. And that has also potentially, you know, caused a friction in the flow of ideas and innovation around the world. But what it's also done is opened up other avenues for collaboration and innovation. For example, I probably wouldn't be having or sitting here and having this virtual interview with you if there was a if there wasn't a pandemic. We might have been talking about, you know, arranging for an interview the next time I was passing through DC, for example, you know, and that might have taken 6, 8, 12 months. But now, you know, you can just pick up a phone and ask someone, you know, can you, you know, log on online and have a conversation? And so I think in some ways we have the silver linings. But to agri-food systems specifically, I think, yes, there's been the global slowdown in productivity. You know, we've seen the reduction in productivity. We've also seen a reduction in demand. And so it's exposed, as I said earlier, certain fragilities and vulnerabilities in the agri-food systems. Of course, the world is far more interconnected and globalized than it was a century ago when we had the last global pandemic. But what this global pandemic has shown us is that there's a lot more that we need to do as practice and thought leaders in strengthening resilience to shocks and stresses. Previously, we were preoccupied with climate change. It's not like climate change has decided to take a pause because we have a global pandemic. We're still dealing with climate change. We're still dealing with malnutrition, you know, and now on top of all this, we have a global pandemic. And so what this tells me really is agriculture and food systems is a sector that requires the smartest minds. You know, you cannot have people, you know, not pulling their weight. You really need your brightest thinkers. Your most, your bravest practitioners, your fiercest entrepreneurs, your most ambitious and visionary public policy specialists to ensure that we build resilient systems around agri-food systems, not just at the local level, but at the country, regional, and global levels.
Talking about climate change, we recently experienced, for example, drought. Very, very serious drought in southern Africa, and also floods.
That's correct. I mean, that's the conundrum that is climate change. We have variability in precipitation, it's rainfall, and temperature. So some places are getting wetter, others are getting drier, some places are getting hotter, other parts are getting cooler. But it's not even on a linear trajectory. So it's variable. In some seasons, you have extreme wet conditions. In subsequent seasons, you have extreme dry conditions. Take, for example, Nigeria. Most recently, parts of Nigeria have been inundated with floods, devastating large agrarian states in the north of the country. I've been reading reports of most of the rice crop for this season being lost. So, you know, when you see these kinds of things, it's also then balanced by a recent report I was reading online today that Cape Town, all the dams in Cape Town are now full to capacity. And so you think, hang on, you know, Cape Town was previously suffering a drought, and now you have floods in other parts of the world. So you have this variability. Unfortunately, we cannot control these parameters, and so When we look at the impact, the sort of the knock-on impact on the Earth's ability to sustain not just life, but sustain life in a manner that is conducive for human beings to maximize their potential individually and collectively, we realize there's a lot more that we need to do. And within the AGRF partners group, we have partners who are working, you know, assiduously towards ensuring that we build resilient systems to ensure that agriculture and food systems can absorb the shocks and stresses of climate change and bounce back and maintain high levels of productivity. One example was the most recently last week, the African Development Bank inaugurated the Africa office of the Global Center on Adaptation. The Global Center on Adaptation is going to be catalytic. It's going to leverage private sector funds, also influence public sector policy to ensure that at the national and local levels, we can invest in the right infrastructure programs and designs that give us the best chance of building resilient systems that are interconnected.
Very interesting. Here in the United States, Dr. Araba, interestingly, there are still people, and I'm talking about some very powerful people, who are still sort of the doubting Thomases. They still have problems with the climate change. They still have problems with whether it is a science or whether it is a hoax. What about the African authorities? When you interact with them, do you get the sense that they know that when you talk about climate change, you are talking about the real thing, and you should perhaps be able to be guided by science rather than being skeptical?
Yes, thank you very much, Shaka. From my personal experience interacting with the leaders in public sector and also private sector, because again, in the global, shall we call it the global ecosystem of the climate change debate, you still have leaders in private sector as well who are skeptics around whether climate change is real. But you see, the beauty of working with people who have skin in the game, who have their roots connected to the ground, so to speak, is if you've interacted with farmers, or you are involved in the agri-food systems, as you will find most ministers of agriculture invariably are, they will tell you they may not have the hard data, but they can give you anecdotes of a changing climate. The anecdotes that support the fact that the climate is changing. They could tell you the weather, maybe it's the rainfalls weren't this heavy previously, or the rain season wasn't, you know, used to be a longer duration or used to be a shorter duration, or the winters were colder or warmer. They can give you anecdotes that buttress and validate climate change. And so what we're doing on the continent is ensuring that we improve on the communication of science, because science in and of itself is good. Science is sacrosanct. But for science to matter and for science to deliver on the impact and the changes that we require, we really need to be better with our communication. And that's something, I'll give an example. Most recently, a very dear friend of mine, Dr. Bruce Campbell, who leads the CGIAR program on climate change, agriculture, and food security, has been campaigning to improve the communication of science. He feels that scientists need to be better communicators, because that's the only way that we maybe allow the penny to drop, so to speak, for public policymakers and also for private sector investors. And the reason why it's important, it might be intuitive for why it's important for a government to understand the science of climate change, but why is this important to private sector? Take, for example, an investor. If you're going to invest for the long term in any crop or in any value chain, you really want to ensure that you are hedging your investment and insulating your investment against climate vulnerabilities. And that helps us, you know. So one of the outcomes of this is the improvement in the robustness of climate insurance products, climate finance products and services, instruments that inform the infrastructure that will be built, or the financial instruments that will be created. So there's an increase in sophistication of what's going on in the private sector space now, and I think it's one of the outcomes of improving the communication from the science.
What about the tools or the infrastructure? Do you have the tools, the necessary tools, the appropriate infrastructure?
We have an infrastructure deficit and also a resilience infrastructure deficit, significant one, to the tune of billions of dollars. Now, for us to improve and invest in crowding in more investments, or to crowd in more investments to build resilience, both from public sector and private sector, you really need to up the science and improve the sophistication of the communication of the science. Now, one example of this is the climate risk profiles and the climate smart agriculture investment plans that that's been developed by the International Center for Tropical Agriculture, now within the Alliance of Biodiversity International and SEAT. Now, what these profiles do is they look at agri-food at different points of the value chain where the vulnerabilities are. They identify the vulnerabilities, they identify the severity of the vulnerabilities, look at the adaptation measures already adopted by various value chain actors, and then advise on where the gaps are and what can be invested to improve resilience. And I think it's when we take these profiles and others and we map them not just at the subnational level, at the country level, at the regional level, we're able to truly, you know, catalyze not just informing public sector investments, because again, countries have budgets and budgets are limited. And so you really want to inform countries to maximize their budgets every single year. But more importantly, you're starting to see countries become more sophisticated in how they deploy national resources. So countries are engaging with the private sector more, maybe in more blended partnerships, where you are leveraging public resources to catalyze and crowd in private investments. And I think that's the model that we really need to adopt to go to scale. There's so much we still need to do. We need to build those roads. We need to build dams. We need to ensure that there is green energy, sustainable energy that is not exacerbating the production of greenhouse gases. We need to ensure that the agri-food systems, the world is going to be about 10 billion people by 2050. We want to ensure that our agri-food systems are able to deliver, you know, safe, healthy, nutritious foods to these people in a way that doesn't exacerbate and accelerate.
We talked about climate change, and we talked about the effects, for example, of the coronavirus pandemic. What about also the issue of the locust invasion on the East African side? What is the situation like? What does it look like from your vantage point?
Another of the AGRF partners, as I said, we really are the broad-based community of partners. The United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization is leading the charge on this. They have a monitoring center where they monitor the movement of the swarms of these desert locusts through satellite imagery, visual sighting, etc. And they're also deploying sophisticated containment and control measures. There are lots of investments going into bio pest control measures, understanding the breeding patterns, the swarming patterns of these locusts to see how we can contain them and control them. The locust, as you may be aware, I know your viewers, some of your viewers might have heard this in the news, are still swarming. It is a challenge, a significant challenge. I think for development and donor partners out there, even private sector partners out there, my call is support the people on the front lines. You know, they need your support right now. If your support is in technical services, financial services, it is needed right now. Thoughts and prayers are good, but money is even better. Now, looking at how we control these swarms, we've also seen institutions step up to the plate, like ISIPE, based in Kenya. And ISIPE is focused on understanding the life cycles of these desert locusts and figuring out bioremediation control measures that control the size and movement of the swarms without creating any secondary negative impact on the environment. Of course, you can spray your pesticides, and you know, with the pesticides, you might have a secondary damage either to crops or to livestock. But what we're trying to do is ensure that we control the desert locusts without that secondary impact on any other sector.
What is ACIMI? Are you talking about a respectable research organization?
Set up by a Kenyan, Dr. Odhiambo, the current Director General is Dr. Segenet Kelemu, who is an Ethiopian national, and who is doing amazing work on the control measures, but also leading research on increasing our knowledge of what's really going on. Because the more we understand the breeding cycles, the patterns of these desert locusts, I think we can move from a reactionary measure to a pro, we can be more proactionary rather than reactionary to the swarms of the desert.
What we have said so far, talk to us about the situation regarding food security or food insecurity on the continent from your vantage point.
You've possibly heard the saying that we currently produce more than enough food to go around the world. People talk about food loss and food waste as being the limiting factors, the binding constraints, limiting everybody living on the planet or everyone alive on the planet having adequate food. But the question, Shaka, is not just about how much food we have available, because that's looking at calories, right? So when you eat, you look at the package of your food, you see the calorific content, and you've heard people tell you, oh, go on a low-calorie diet, or you shouldn't be exceeding 2,500 or 2,200 calories for men, 1,500 or 1,800 calories for women. That's the energy content in food. But what we need to focus on is the nutritional content. You know, and you have your macronutrients, your carbohydrates, proteins, fats, minerals, you know, but then you have your micronutrients, like zinc, iron, vitamin A. Now, these are trace nutrients that lead to what we call hidden hunger, where people have full stomachs. You can eat and be full, but your body isn't receiving adequate nutrition. Let me give you an analogy. When you plant a crop, you plant a crop, and people say, or maybe even better, human beings, when you eat, you expect to get most of your nutrients from the food you consume. But once in a while, you might go to your doctor or medical practitioner, and they will prescribe you pills, vitamin pills, multivitamins, or certain vitamins. Why are they prescribing those to you? It's because you are deficient in those vitamins, which are critical for healthy well-being. Now, most of the food we consume is supposed to deliver these nutrition outcomes. But the challenge we've had is there's been a focus in previous decades on ramping up the consumption of calorie-dense foods to the detriment of nutrient-dense foods. And so now we are creating a shift, almost a complete, not a complete 180, but a shift to diversify the diets that people consume. We talked earlier about a staple in East Africa, ugali, made from maize.
And the sukuma wiki.
That's right. You know, the sukuma is probably more critical, you know, to your nutritional outcome than the ugali. But let's even assume you get your energy from the ugali. Mm-hmm. But what we want to do is promote a more diversified diet. So you should be complementing your diet, you know, with the carbohydrates, with the vegetables, which are nutrient dense, you know. And these, the challenge with delivering these nutrient dense foods is most of them are highly perishable, Shaka. And so
I think for the sake of our audience, we should inform them that ugali is a sort of bread that comes out of maize, which is called corn in North America. And sukuma wiki is, as a matter of fact, referred to as the collard greens.
That's correct. Now, how do we develop systems that ensure that we can move these nutrient-dense foods from farms, from where they're produced, to consumers in a condition that is affordable, accessible, safe and nutritious. We want to encourage. Yes, exactly. And so one of those innovations that I would like to mention and give a shout out to a startup on the continent is Cold Hubs. Cold Hubs is investing in off-grid solar-powered refrigeration systems, mm-hmm. where they are supporting fresh wet markets, fresh produce markets, and also farms to ensure that they can invest in affordable energy. And of course, there's in addition to a resource, a finance deficit, there's an energy deficit on the continent. We have partners working to ensure that we bridge this gap. And Cold Hubs is one of them with their innovations in off-grid solar-powered refrigeration systems.
As I often say, time is not our best ally. We'll go for a break, and when we come back, we shall continue with the discussion. So please, don't go away, because we'll be right back with you.
Health, wellness, sport, beauty, medical breakthroughs. Healthy Living cares about your well-being. What are the main health concerns in Africa and around the world? Find out the latest on coronavirus. Connect with our experts and ask them questions.
How long does the virus stay?
Join me, Lino Khmudu, in Washington, every week on Healthy Living, right here on VOA.
Welcome back to Straight Talk Africa. And today we are talking about how agriculture can become a critical pathway to prosperity in Africa.
Joining us today is Dr. Debisi Araba, the Managing Director of the African Green Revolution Forum, and he joins us from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. Can be harnessed? Is it a sort of energy that can easily be harnessed by your average African city?
Oh, yes. You have startups, like I mentioned, Cold Hubs, that has made this solar-powered energy affordable and accessible. In Kenya, you have a startup that's focused on franchising the sort of modular investments in solar energy called M-Copper, where you invest in the financing and they provide the different components and you build it up together and you have a long-term low-interest financing repayment scheme backed by a few large-scale investors like the African Development Bank. I think, look, we need to ensure energy accessibility. So it's not just power, it's really energy. And so there's a vibrant ecosystem, a rich a group of technology scientists, engineers, and investors across the continent working on different aspects of the energy gap. In Morocco, we've seen great investments in the desert solar power investments that the government of Morocco has invested in, the largest of its type in the world. Of course, Africa has that solar potential, especially the equatorial countries, you know. And we're seeing the governments begin to provide the enabling environment for lots of these solar entrepreneurs, you know, coming into the space. In the agri-food space, lots of them working on processing, preservation, irrigation. Now we have solar-powered irrigation systems that are completely off-grid, and so now you don't need to burn fossil fuels to irrigate your farms. And of course, once you can irrigate a farm, you ensure that you decouple your productivity from seasonality of the weather, which is very important. Until 2013, Nigeria cropped rice just once a season. Why? Because they cropped it with the rains. And after Akin Adesina, as you mentioned, you know, came in, he brought in a push to have a dual cropping. And there was now dry season farming where there was heavy investments in irrigation infrastructure for smallholder farmers and large-scale farmers. And so that, of course, doubles the productivity. Now you're cropping you're cropping rice twice in a season. You're increasing the productivity. And in simple economic terms, what you're doing is ultimately leading to a reduction in the price of what's available in the market of domestically produced grain.
Is that also when he encouraged agricultural diversity to the extent that he increased, for example, investments in cassava?
So he did quite a lot of things, all of which we're grateful for and proud. I suppose probably led to him being elected as the president of the African Development Bank due to his ideas around productivity and prosperity. For cassava, he focused, you know, single-mindedly on diversifying the crop, diversifying the derivatives from cassava, making it, you know, converting it from a staple food crop to an industrial crop. Because for cassava, there's so many derivatives that you can get from cassava. You can get high fructose cassava syrup to replace the high fructose corn syrup, which is a substitute for sugar in the confectionery industry. You can get cassava starch for the starch industry. You can, of course, produce high-quality cassava flour, which can be blended with maize, with wheat, and other flours. To bake the bread, you know, and other pastries. So there are lots of derivatives that you can get from cassava if you focus on it as an industrial crop. And of course, you also have the glue that you can produce from cassava. So what he did was identify a crop that Nigeria produces 44 million metric tons of cassava every year, but very little value addition. And so he focused on value addition, you know, with a mind of increasing and catalyzing investments into it. Why? Because if most farmers in the Southwest or most parts of Nigeria are farming, are growing cassava, if you increase the derivatives, what you're doing is increasing the income earning potential of investors across the cassava value chain, not just the producers, but the processors and the consumers. Again, just one of the great things that he did when he was Minister of Agriculture in Nigeria.
Dr. Raba, when I was growing up, I often heard that when it came to agriculture, that Africa produced what it did not consume and consumed what it did not produce. How far have we gone in changing those types of attitudes so that we can begin seriously to first and foremost feed ourselves and in fact perhaps have even a surplus for exportation?
That's a very good question, Shaka. I think there is anecdote and there is science-backed facts. Now, here's the fact. 80 to 90% of food consumed on the continent is produced by SMEs on the continent. And so Africa is by far producing most of what it consumes, it produces. That's the fact. This and more information can be found in this year's African Agriculture Status Report, which was launched at the AGRF Summit, which held from the 8th to the 11th of September. I think we'll come to that shortly before we wrap up this engaging conversation. But on the other side, I think there's a lot more to be said about where food comes from. When I worked at the International Center for Tropical Agriculture, there's a brilliant scientists, colleagues of mine who published a paper on the origins of certain staple crops. And when you realize very few of these crops are endemic, not just to Africa, but to Europe and South America. You know, you have crops that are endemic to the Andes in South America, consumed in Asia, consumed in Africa, consumed in the world, consumed in other parts of the world. Because why? We're a globalized economy now. So I don't think it is helpful to focus on producing what we consume or consuming what we produce. I think it's really about prosperity, ultimately. If you ask anybody invested in the agri-food space, why are you there? Especially, let's take the farmers. Take a sample of farmers and ask them, why are you a bean farmer? Why are you raising poultry? Why are you raising goats? Why are you growing maize? It's not necessarily because of some intrinsic love for the crop or the animal. Mm-hmm. It's because they're business people. They want to turn a profit. And they're very rational in the decisions they make. That's why you will see some farmers or some people can be farmers in one season and might invest in a motorcycle and go into transportation, you know, the following year, and come back into agriculture the a year after that. That doesn't mean they're you know, capricious. It's just that they're making investment decisions. They're looking at the margins. So agriculture is a business of margins at every single level, all the way from your smallholder farmer to your large-scale agribusiness. Everyone's out for the margins. And so how can we create the nudges, the incentives for this margin pursuit business to deliver on improved nutrition, to deliver on more jobs, more sustainable jobs, to deliver on, you know, wealth and prosperity for millions? That's the big challenge for us. We need to understand who we're dealing with and who is invested in the agri-food space.
Dr. Roba, you know as well as I do that maize bread or corn bread, ugali, it's called ugali in Kenya and Tanzania or East Africa in general. And when you go to West Africa, especially in Ghana, they call it fufu. Where did the maize or corn originate from? Is it indigenous to Africa?
No, it's not. So you have maize in South America. It's a South American crop. The same way you have potatoes as a South American crop. But because of globalized trade, people moved around. They brought seeds or seedlings. Even cassava is not an African crop.
What about bananas? Ugandans are very, very proud of their bananas. Are Ugandan bananas indigenous to Africa? Or are they, in fact, the last time I checked, seems like they may, in fact, have come from Asia?
That is correct. So again, bananas and there are multiple varieties of bananas, as you know. In Uganda, they have a variety, the matoke, that isn't, you know, the soft Cavendish that you see everywhere around the world now.
You have plantains.
Exactly. Now, speaking specifically about bananas, there's something else I wanted to mention. You know, when you again think about the globalized nature of agri-food systems, the most popular variety we have now is the Cavendish. And the Cavendish banana, if you go to any supermarket, retail store, it's likely what you see on shelves. And that is a result, the Cavendish banana. It's yellow, it's curved, it's thin. That's a popular one.
Yes.
And it's because of global market systems, because consumers kept saying, we want more of this. And if those signals filter up to production, you optimize your production systems to produce a mono cropped variety.
Very interesting.
Previous to the Cavendish, you had the Gros Michel. And the Gros Michel...
In Uganda, they call it Bogoya.
Oh, there you go. And so... previous to the Cavendish, you had the Gros Michel, which was more buttery, slightly similar but different to the Cavendish. But it fell victim to a global virus, a global disease that wiped out most of the banana plantations. We are now witnessing an emergence of a similar type of disease plaguing the Cavendish. And so it is possible that we will find another variety to overtake this. But what I love about African agriculture and Africa, especially about bananas, is there is a wide variety of bananas available. You know, we don't have that issue of a mono variety. If you go to supermarkets, go to your local, what do you call them? The stalls in Kenya, you call them the mamambogas.
Yes.
Right. I've heard this being used, so I wasn't sure if it was correct in context. But, you know, everywhere you go, you find a diversity in varieties. And I think that is something that we need to keep. You know, when you talk about food availability of food, the diversity of food available in African markets is very high. And we need to ensure that we don't lose that even as we industrialize and we expand with our urbanization, not just within countries, but across the continent. Because I think the world can learn about this from Africa. You know, we need to maintain that diversity.
Very interesting. Let's go back to the recent African Green Revolution Forum 10th Annual Summit, which you said was a virtual summit held in part in the Rwandan capital, Kigali. Could you please walk us through what you would consider to be the major highlights?
Thank you very much, Shaka. So the AGRF summit, the history of the AGRF, maybe I'll begin there. The AGRF started in 2007 in Norway as the Africa Green Revolution Conferences. And it was held in Norway for 3 years before, at the insistence and persuasion of the late Mr. Kofi Annan, when he made the call for a truly African Green Revolution, the inaugural AGRF summit was held in Africa in the city of Accra in 2010. And since 2012, where the 2012 event was held in Tanzania, in the city of Arusha, it's become an annual summit. Now, each year, we bring together the leading minds, the leading practitioners, so the thought leaders, practice leaders, everybody involved in agriculture transformation is involved in the AGRF. The AGRF, as I mentioned, is a community of platforms. We have 10 thematic platforms. There was the agri investment and SME finance, regional trade, rural market development, food systems and nutrition, resilience and adaptation, policy and state capability, youth entrepreneurship in agriculture, women in agriculture, agriculture technology and digitalization, and sustainable productivity. We have these 10 thematic platforms. One of the big emerging outcomes from the AGRF is our ability to convene for increasing catalytic finance for SMEs. And so one of our marquee segments is the agribusiness deal room, which is growing from strength to strength year on year. Mm-hmm. Within the agribusiness deal room, we're doing three things. We're mapping demand, where the needs are for finance. We're mapping supply, who is available to fund SMEs. But we're also providing a platform for advocacy, because when you then approach governments to create that enabling environment, remember I talked about transformation as public sector enabled, private sector led process, right?
Right.
How do you provide the evidence for governments to create the enabling environment? It's through the evidence that we generate from platforms such as the Agribusiness Deal Room. This year's summit, the focus was feed the cities, grow the continent, leveraging urban food markets to achieve sustainable food systems in Africa.
What exactly was that supposed to mean?
that's good. Okay. Thanks for slowing me down, Shaka. So we wanted to bring a sharp focus to cities. As African cities continue to urbanize and we continue to see an increased rate of urbanization across the continent, what we want to do is ensure that the agri-food system is able to leverage on the strengths that cities have as growth poles, as economic poles, to ensure that we're delivering on resilience, we're delivering on improving nutrition and health, leveraging these cities for improved markets and trade, not just within countries, but regionally and also globally. And then, of course, working at transforming food systems. What is a food system? A food system is a system of different aspects around agriculture and food. So the finance of it, the public policy of it, the health of it, the nutrition, the energy issues, everything involved in ensuring that people have access to healthy, safe, nutritious food in a way that creates sustainable, dignified jobs and ensures economic wealth and prosperity goes into the food systems. And so we also want to ensure that we are delivering agri-food systems in a way that enables us to continue on this pathway to prosperity on the continent.
Where does the funding for the AGRF come from?
We're very grateful to our network of partners. We have a partners group who fund our operations. They cut across different groups. We have development organizations, international finance organizations. We have private sector organizations at different scales. We have national governments. Of course, the secretariat of the AGRF is hosted by the government of Rwanda. We have our secretariat physically in the city of Kigali. This was finalized last year. And so we have this network of partners who are single-minded and I think aligned on this vision of agriculture transformation. And so what we have is we have the benefit of a coalition of partners willing to provide the resources for Africa to fulfill this potential of agriculture transformation.
Any particular reason why you chose Kigali, the Rwandan capital? The last time I checked, Rwanda is known for so many things, but certainly not a champion in agriculture.
Well, fun fact, Chaka, did you know that Rwanda has the highest consumption per capita of beans in the world?
Of beans?
Yes. In the whole world, yeah. Anyway, that's a sidebar. It was a competitive process. We put out the terms of reference, and we had a few cities compete to host. And so, under the terms of the agreement, Rwanda will host the AGR Secretariat for the next 5 years, from 2020 to 2025.
I used to blindly think that if there is anybody who pretty much had a stronghold on the beans, the almighty beans we call them, the Bachiga people of southwestern Uganda, and where I come from, Kabale.
There you go. So Rwanda is a consumption powerhouse, but bean, incidentally, it's also the highest traded crop on the continent of Africa.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
Now talk to us about your efforts to make agriculture, or agro-business for that matter. But before we go there, what is the difference between when we talk about agriculture and agro-business?
These two are complementary, mm-hmm. but different. Agriculture is a process. Agribusiness is the business of that process. So it's the business of agriculture. Agribusiness is the business of agriculture. It's as simple as that.
How far have you gone trying or attempting to make agribusiness more attractive, especially to the African educated youth?
Yes, thank you very much, Shaka. This is one of the thematic platforms that's dear to my heart. As I mentioned, the 10 thematic platforms within the AGRF, we have the Youth Entrepreneurship Thematic Platform that we have branded as Generation Africa. Mm-hmm. Generation Africa is fixed, it's focused, it's the biggest, boldest move, I think, on the continent for youth entrepreneurship by any mile and at any scale. Now, within the AGRF, it's a numbers game, Shaka. You have to provide a sharp, compelling value proposition for investing for the youth to go into agribusiness. Now, let me give you another quick fact. I'm a numbers person, as you might come to expect. Now, globally,
I confess that I was less than a mediocre in mathematics.
Globally speaking, the agri-food system contributes about $8 trillion to the global economy. That's about 10% of global GDP. Now, that's no small number. And so when you want to talk about what the value proposition for investing in agri-food or being an agripreneur, that's where you begin to tell people, look, you have the potential to tap into an $8 trillion business. That's the potential. And to think that we are still scratching the surface on the potential of African economies to trade with each other, to maximize their potential. And so once you begin to create that enabling environment, investing in infrastructure, investing in the trade links, investing in transportation, investing in energy, you know, investing in market systems, you begin to see that the numbers make sense. Now, you have agribusinesses, for example, like Tomato Joss. Tomato Joss is a startup based in the state of Kaduna in northern Nigeria, where they're working on completely overhauling the extension production franchising system for producing tomatoes. Mm-hmm. Now, Tomato Joss farmers, I believe, have exceeded the national yield by a factor of 2 or 3. You know, that's how much they've increased the yield of their farmers by adopting, you know, the highest yielding varieties, adopting the best agronomic practices, etc. and they are now moving to investing in technologies for processing the tomatoes. This year, Tomato Joss received equity funding of $4.2 million. Mm-hmm. That's not a small number to shake a stick at, you know? Really? And so if investors are putting money into Tomato Joss, what that tells you is there is value in agribusiness. You know, another, agribusiness based in Kenya is Twiga Foods. Twiga Foods are, big on investing in technologies that maximize supply chain management for smallholder farmers and retailers. They're investing in technologies on inventory management, supply chain management, etc. And they've also raised serious funding from investors. And so we as the AGRF, we're also looking to promote and present, and communicate the successes of these startups to show the youth that we have an opportunity here, maybe a once-in-a-generation opportunity, to ensure that Africa doesn't just feed itself and feed the world, but creates these long-term, highly dignified, sustainable jobs. You know, there are jobs at different scales. There are jobs available or entrepreneurship opportunities available at the production end of the value chain, processing, distribution, input services, service delivery, retail, at the consumption level. There's so many opportunities, business opportunities, that we think we will continue to work with the youth through Generation Africa. One of the marquee segments or outputs from Generation Africa is the annual Go Getters Entrepreneurship Prize, where we solicit ideas from youth entrepreneurs, and then we award the winners. And we think, look, the longer we continue this, the longer we are able to show that there is an incentive, there is a market incentive, there is a business incentive for the youth to invest in agribusiness, and there is, value. I've already told you, agribusiness is a game of margins. It really is. If we can improve those margins for them and show them, then we think, the opportunity is limitless.
When you talk about agriculture in Africa, the average African thinks about this is a role for women. Women are the main agricultural producers. This is a role for peasant farmers. But somebody who has got some college or tertiary institution or university credential, how does he really get attracted to that business? How do you make it sexy? How do you make it environmentally friendly so much that he can, in fact, overcome some of these traditional mindsets?
I think there's fact, and then there's anecdotes and how we feel about the agri-food sector. One of the anecdotes that we used to work with until we had the evidence that brought it into question was Africa's farmers were aging. Our farmers aren't aging. If anything, the average age of people investing in agribusiness and entrepreneurship is reducing. It's coming down.
Right.
And why? It's two reasons. People are starting at an earlier age, and more youth are going in there. And so that is bringing down that average age. The average age is coming down significantly.
Well, on that note, my brother, Dr. Aroba, I have to say that it was a pleasure to have the opportunity to interact with you for the first time. And I certainly look forward the next time to meeting you in person, in flesh and blood, in our Washington studios.
Thank you very much, Shaka. We will see each other on the other side of this pandemic, God willing. And thank you very much for having me on your show.
Our distinguished guest is Dr. Debisi Aroba. Thanks to our audience for tuning in to Straight Talk Africa. And in the meantime, get better, not bitter, the African farmers. And please, please, please remember to keep the African hopes alive.